We're talking about airports and air travel this hour. And did you know that Memphis, Tennessee bills itself as America's Aerotropolis? Yeah, we didn't know that word either until we saw Greg Lindsay's book, Aerotropolis: The Way We'll Live Next. Steve Paulson asked for a definition.
An aerotropolis, as conceived by my co-author John Casarda, who sort of popularized the phrase, is literally a city built around an airport, usually by intention. He discovered the word in China, where they've been building, you know, dozens of these. But it's basically, as he imagines it, a city built around the terminals and around the airfield, starting with sort of cargo rings and expanding out into offices and beyond. But in practice, you know, as I like to think of it, is that, you know, there are many cities that could qualify for the label aerotropolis. It's any city which uses its airport and air travel to connect itself to communities on the other side of the world more closely than the cities in its own region. I looked at places like Dubai, you know, which is really sort of in the middle of nowhere, unless you look at air travel, in which case it's in the center of the world.
So what makes Dubai an aerotropolis?
Well, Dubai is really an airline with an emirate attached to it. I mean, Dubai literally was a city of 20,000 people, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, and they leveraged their airline, Emirates, which is now the world's fastest growing and largest long-haul carrier, to basically become the sort of hub for the middle of the world. And Dubai has really connected people who historically, you know, lived along the Silk Road, as they called it then, and reconnected Africa to Asia and beyond. And so Dubai, which is really off the major trade routes and has no real oil wealth of its own anymore, has really sort of tried to forge itself as this ultimate hub, business hub, entertainment hub, tourism hub for the entire middle of the world.
So it sounds like there's something about this particular moment in history that we're living in right now that demands an aerotropolis. I mean, this wouldn't have happened 50 years ago.
When I started researching the book, I mean, the premise I had is that if we live in an era of globalization, a word we throw around without really attaching a definition to it, then basically we would have to travel global at a global scale. You know, I mean, the internet is one thing and email is great, but, you know, sooner or later we have to meet face to face and we have to ship our iPhones halfway around the world. And if you put enough people and enough money through these places, through these airports, then sooner or later you're going to see these strange side effects happen. You're going to see something sprout around it. And that turned out to be these strange cities. Dubai exists because globalization happened, in large part because of 9/11, in which case America revoked a lot of visas for Arab travelers, which caused them to start changing their focus to China and beyond. And that led to this huge growth in air travel in the Middle East and in Asia. So, you know, this is really sort of, I'd like to think, where globalization is really sort of made flesh in the form of airports, in the form of cities, where we really sort of see these unintended effects of the world finding itself and reconnecting to itself that we literally didn't imagine 10, 11 years ago.
Isn't this a pretty depressing vision of what a future city is going to look like, though? I mean, if these are basically vehicles for delivering goods or delivering people to go on to some business trip, rather than creating vibrant cultures, that's maybe not the city I want to live in.
Well, fortunately, you and I have the choice that we don't have to live in some of these cities. I mean, I think the places that are really embracing the aerotropolis model are the places that are feeling that panic of sudden urbanization. It's places like China, which is going to urbanize 400 million people in the West, moving them out of villages into cities, finding them jobs. They're the ones building this. Or a place like Dubai, which, again, 20,000 native inhabitants, a little bit of oil money, and they were desperate to basically deal themselves into the global economy as they knew it. And, you know, most of the people who live in Dubai are expatriates who are choosing to live there to generate wealth, to forge a name for themselves, something other than sort of, you know, living in the place where they grew up. And then, of course, there's India, you know, which is building a dozen cities from scratch, 2 million people apiece as part of the Delhi-Mumbai industrial corridor. And the simple reason is they need to add a Chicago a year for the next 20 years to handle all these people. So, yeah, I think, you know, the scale of this urban crisis and what's driving it is really different than anything we can imagine here in the U.S.
Now, these kinds of aerotropolises would seem to be very different from most of the airports that we know in the United States. For instance, LAX in Los Angeles is nothing like what you've just been describing.
Well, you know, I mean, an aerotropolis at its core, at least from an American perspective, is the premise is that you should take an airport and you should actively plan for it to become a business hub or to accommodate all this office space. In America, we built almost all of our airports before we knew what they were for. And LAX is a classic example of that. I mean, when they chose the site of LAX in 1929, it was a bean field 15 miles from downtown, and the people who selected it complained that it was too far away. And then you fast forward just 30 or 40 years, and you already have this encroachment on the airport. You already have the first noise lawsuit starting. And today, LAX is hopelessly trapped, surrounded by offices and Inglewood and a massive oil refinery on the southern edge, to the point where you can't expand it. And when they proposed building into the ocean, of course, environmentalists with good reason fought that one to the death. And so LAX is this sort of major hub. It is the entrepot for anyone coming from across Asia. If you live anywhere between Malibu and the Mexican border and you want to fly to Asia, LAX is your only option, and it can't expand. And so we've sort of, you know, painted ourselves into a literal corner when it comes to many of our airports. And in other cases, you know, we've surrounded them with auto plants and cement factories, some of the most horrible, noisy uses we can think of, because we thought of airports as these terrible nuisances that we never wanted to see. We tried to banish them to the edges of our cities and hope they would stay there. And of course, the city always sort of encroached upon it. Whether we consciously knew it or not, there was some reason to be near the airport. And so most of our airport planning is just terrible, is haphazard, and now it's incredibly expensive. I do think that America, you know, needs to rethink our relationship with our airports. We need to do a better job of accommodating them somehow, rather than thinking we can banish them and never have to think about them again.
Now, it would seem that there is a huge shadow that hangs over this whole new kind of airport city and the economy that it's built on, and it's highly dependent on oil. And we know oil is a non-renewable resource. Presumably, at some point, it's going to run out, not to mention the problems we might have with climate change. It raises the question of whether it's really wise to build cities that so obviously depend on oil consumption for air travel.
And that's part of the larger question of whether it's wise to build a civilization on oil and a global scale, which is exactly what we've done for the last 50 years. It's interesting when it comes to air travel and oil. You know, there's a long run and a short run answer and problem with this. You know, in the short run, it's interesting is that time has continued to increase in value and cost ahead of oil. And by that, I mean the fact that despite, you know, oil prices going to well over $100 a barrel, you're still seeing double-digit growth in air travel in places like India, China, and the Middle East. All these places where with a rapidly growing middle class who are finally discovering the value of their time and their ability to project their talents across these huge regions. And so you see there's a great sort of rule of thumb that even though oil prices destroy demand through high fares, rising incomes create it even faster. We reach this sort of weird paradoxical situation right now in the United States where air travel is sort of very flat, where we can't afford to fly not because the prices of tickets are going up. We can't afford to fly because we can't afford to fill our SUVs. We're watching our disposable incomes be destroyed by basically the fact that we have to drive to work every day. And then when it comes to goods, I mean, what's interesting is people have said that sooner or later it won't be economical to ship an iPhone around the world. Well, that's not quite true, because what's interesting is that the reason that we started outsourcing all these things to Asia is not because it was really cheap to fly from the other side of the world. It's because the value of those goods has gone up so much over time that the percentage of what it costs to fly it has fallen. So if you have a $500 iPhone, the cost of what it takes to ship it via FedEx from China is a tiny percentage of the total cost you're willing to pay for it. So that makes all the other advantages of building in China so much greater.
Your book features two epigraphs, one from the British writer J.G. Ballard, who says, "I suspect that the airport will be the true city of the 21st century." And the second is from the Swiss architect Le Corbusier, who said, "A city made for speed is made for success." I'm curious about why you picked those two quotations.
I picked both of those quotations so as you start to read the book that you see them as a flashing red light or perhaps a flashing yellow light, a caution or a stop before proceeding forward, that you think about the contents therein and the utopian promises contained. J.G. Ballard, of course, everything you read of his is dripping with venomous satire. And so I knew, of course, he didn't mean that on some level, but I did think that Ballard thought that was, in fact, the future. He was right about it, even though he wanted to be wrong. And Le Corbusier, of course, the ultimate seduction of that. Following Le Corbusier's principles, we made some of the worst urban mistakes we could ever make. And so I think anyone should be extremely cautious about building a city from scratch or thinking that it can be built from scratch. Of course, the great paradox is that we need to build cities from scratch that have never been built before. We're entering a phase of building that, you know, is unmatched. And so what are we supposed to do? It's this horrible sort of paradox. We don't know how to build the perfect city overnight, and yet we're being forced to.
Greg Lindsay is the co-author, along with John Casarda, of Aerotropolis, The Way We'll Live Next. He spoke with Steve Paulson.